Thanks, Kim. I became interested in this survival of microorganisms in stream water when I was asked to provide some information to the Iowa DNR. They were conducting a TMDL study in the Raccoon River, trying to assess the sources and patterns of bacterial contamination in that river. And one of the things that they specifically asked me for was survival in stream water. And I thought, well, this would be pretty easy. We've covered this before. And when I went to the literature, I found less information that I was happy about than I thought I would. Previous studies have looked at survival of E. coli for decades, and they've often used single lab-grown strains under pretty contrived conditions, sometimes with sterile water, sometimes with not. Few studies have looked at that in stream water. Quite a few of the studies have been done in lake water or in ocean water. The studies have examined the effects of temperature, salinity, light, protozoa, suspended sediments, to name a few kinds of parameters. And of course, the knowledge of survival is critical to modeling transport of pathogens in watersheds. So our objectives were to determine the survival of E. coli and Enterococcus in stream water. And specifically, we want to look at the variability in this and use the natural populations instead of adding laboratory strains into water samples. We wanted to look at the variability within watersheds so we would have some idea of the value of the parameters that we got back out. And so I'll cover that in about the first two-thirds of my talk, and then I'll provide some additional stuff how we can look at survival parameters and combine that with stream flow to look at the movement of these indicator bacteria in watersheds. Our study location is the South Fork of the Iowa River. The TILTH lab, now the National Lab for Agriculture and Environment, it's been up there since about 2002, and we've been looking at E. coli and Enterococcus being transported in that in addition to some nutrients. It's primarily a corn and soybean watershed. It has extensive tile drainage, and potential sources are swine, cattle, wildlife, and you can see there's some pictures of the different parts of the watershed. This is kind of the uplands area, showing some manure, swine manure application. There are some cattle in the upper part of the watershed, quite a few more cattle in the lower part of the watershed where they have pasture ground near the stream. For this study, we used sampling locations here, 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 and here. This is the scale. This is 8 miles, so you can see it's a fairly large watershed. This is the general pattern of E. coli and Enterococcus over the summer, and we see this pattern year after year in basically the same kind of form with a peak in populations in August and September, and then they tend to decline. The second reason that we're really kind of interested in this midsummer peak, where we have quite a few E. coli and Enterococcus, and we're in a period where we don't really have any obvious runoff contributions to that. In fact, many of the tile lines dry up. And so the question becomes, well, where did these E. coli and Enterococcus come from? This shows flow for, I think, 2007, the year that we did this work. This is temperature here, And this is flow at SF450. This is the base of the watershed. And of course, we get, during storm events, get quite a large peak in flow. The units of flow are cubic feet per second. And these are some of the other sampling sites where we can measure flow. And generally, we're looking at flows that run from nearly non-measurable up to about 1,000 CFS. Oh, and these dots up here show the time periods where we took our samples. So we have the six sample locations, and the way we did this is we took about a liter of water and measured the temperature of the water in the field and brought those back into the laboratory, made our initial measurement of E. coli and Enterococcus within about 6 hours, and we set these in controlled environment temperatures using the average water temperature of the samples. And we incubate them with a light dark cycle, and each time that we sample, we go in and kind of shake them up and draw out a sample and measure the population. And so for each sample, we get this time course of data, and we can determine using regression, the first order die-off kinetics, and eventually we get a population of those rate constants of survival, and we can do some statistics on those. They seem to fit first order pretty well. Generally, the R-squares are above 0.9, and the F-values are positive at the 0.05 level. So we'll get to the first part of our results here. If we take that population of rate constants, or half-lives, and that's what I'm showing here is a half-life. It's just like the log reduction cycle, except the time in hours to achieve half the population to die off. If we look at those and use analysis of variance, we find out that the sampling location effect is not really significant for either Enterococcus or E. coli. There is somewhat of a little trend in some ways that, for instance, for Enterococcus here, as we go down in the watershed, it appears that the Enterococcus is surviving less at the lower part of the watershed, but statistically that's just not borne out. We do have a statistical effect and difference between E. coli and Enterococcus. E. coli is less persistent, it has a half-life of about 18 hours, whereas Enterococcus had a half-life of about 24 hours. Sampling date, however, was significant at the 10% level, and for E. coli, it appears that the E. coli are more persistent late in the year when water temperature is low. I'm hesitant to say that's actually a temperature effect because there's lots of other things that are happening in this stream besides just changing water temperature. Along with the water temperature, you change the population of algae, presumably protozoa, other kinds of things are in those samples. So it's a sampling date effect. For Enterococcus, basically all these bars are statistically similar except for this one, and that's the August sampling, and E. coli is the least persistent in August at the same time when its population is generally greatest. So to kind of sum up, we have this sampling time effect. We don't have a sampling location effect. We could use our average parameters for modeling purposes with some knowledge of how those vary in magnitude, those die-off rate constants. And lastly, I'd like to show you just a couple of things that I think are kind of interesting. Survival really governs transport. If you think about source tracking. This is useful to that as well. If we have a point source event such as this, this is runoff from a cattle feed yard. There's lots of E. coli in there, lots of Enterococcus. Waste essentially behaves like a point source. And we've used this equation where K is our survival rate constant, and we use the average E. coli rate constant to construct this graph. X is a distance traveled, and V is stream water velocity. We get estimates of water velocity from the sites where we measure flow. And each of those flow sites are so-called gauge. They have a response that depicts flow and volume of water transported, and from that you can calculate how fast the water's flowing. So we've used just some general different flows here. 10 CFS, which would be representative of periods of time in late summer when we have virtually no runoff events, to 500 CFS, which is a fairly moderate storm event. And we can look at the fraction of E. coli that are transported some distance from any particular source. And so let's just focus here at 10.1. So 10% of E. coli are transported less than 50 kilometers at low flow and transported about 200 kilometers at high flow. So the point source picture that I showed you where we had 240,000 E. coli per 100 mils, 10% of that could be transported 200 kilometers. Well, how does that match up to our watershed? From the source area, the very northwestern part of our watershed, where basically we say the watershed starts, to the base, the last sampling site that we have is about 150 kilometers. So basically during storm flow, E. coli are transported out of our watershed. 10% of them might be completely transported out of the watershed, depending on where that point source would be. So I think that has some relevance to, you know, if you're using a tool like Warren-Dix, you know, that is subject to the same kind of mathematics of transport, although it might be modified by the survival, say, of bacteria dailies. And then lastly, what was the effect of variation in bacterial survival? And it's the same kind of curve again. And what we've done is we've looked at two different flows, 10 CFS and 100 CFS. Here's the 100 CFS, here's the 10. And we've looked at our average E. coli survival rate and added and subtracted one standard deviation. Well, clearly transport's really governed by flow and survival. Survival variations in survival could produce some differences. For instance, if the survival was less than what we actually measured, say one standard deviation less, 10% would be transported only about 100 kilometers. And if it was more, plus one standard deviation, would be about 160 kilometers. So to cap up, we've gotten some data that I think is useful for modelers. We've looked at the variation that we would normally encounter in a water quality monitoring program, effect of site, effect of time of season, and we've identified some sources of that variation. We don't really know the mechanism of why we have some variations in E. coli survival becoming increased later in the year, but it seems like a temperature effect. And then lastly, we've showed this kind of how transport is affected by survival in water. Even though these are 24-hour half-lives, essentially, these bacteria could be transported quite a large distance. And I think that has some relevance to how we think about figuring out what the sources are and how we're going to mitigate those. Thank you.
I think we have time for questions. very interesting paper. Have you considered what the effect in your incubation would be if you added a small amount of dissolved organic matter as food substrate for the microorganisms?
Well, the way that we did it, they have whatever substrate was in the water.
Exactly.
And
what,
if you...
What if there are additional inputs, would this enable the microbes to survive during that entire period?
My guess is that it would. I mean, that's another experiment, and...
It would be interesting to see what the difference is.
We really tried to consider very carefully, yeah, if there was a method where we could get all the E. coli out of the system and then, but leave everything else in, and did not come up with a very good answer to that problem. Yes? E. coli and enterococci were enumerated with the IDEX products, the InterAlert, and I don't remember what the E. coli product is at the moment, but ColAlert, yeah. The samples become re-aerated at each time that we sample because we kind of shake them up so that we resuspend the sediments and we re-aerate them. We also did a preliminary experiment I didn't show where we actually aerated continuously or not with a little aquarium pump device. And basically those curves of the aerated and non-aerated lie right on top of each other. So they're not in there long enough to, you know, really start fermenting or anything like that.
And our final speaker will be Elaine Berry, who is at with the ARS U.S. Meat Animal Research Center in Clay Center, Nebraska, and she'll be talking about